this summer was a, let's pare it all down. Let's rewrite the curriculum, because what has happened from the summer of 2024 to the summer of 2025, as it relates to the use of design tools, the integration of AI and go-to-market offerings, and how we incorporate this data literacy, those kinds of components and facets have changed so rapidly in the last 12 months that it requires a reassessment and different communication strategies to people who are coming into the field and want to know how it's going to change their career.
Of course. I find myself thinking about students in this day who are going to be completely AI native and born in the world of AI, and what that's going to change as far as education, work, all of that.
Welcome to the AI Marketing Navigator, where we simplify AI marketing to keep you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by DigitalPop, delivering AI marketing automation so your small business thrives. Here's your host, Alex Carlson.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the AI Marketing Navigator. This is your daily compass in the ever-evolving world of AI marketing. I am super excited to be bringing you another interview today with Nick Cawthon. Nick is the principal and owner of Gage Design, a boutique UX consultancy that he founded back in 1999, and that has worked with enterprise clients that include Wells Fargo, Adobe, Oracle, and Walmart. I'm sure you've heard of a couple of those companies. He also has a Master of Philosophy in Human-Computer Interaction and Data Visualization from the University of Sydney. And Nick brings over two decades of experience bridging the academic research with the practical implementation of design solutions. Nick has published influential research on data visualization aesthetics with 375 plus academic citations. He also teaches data visualization at the California College of the Arts and organizes the IXDA San Francisco chapter, which happens to be the largest chapter in the nation with over 4,000 members. Suffice it to say, his unique perspective combines deep, deep technical expertise with real-world enterprise experience, which makes him perfectly positioned to discuss how AI is now transforming design workflows and what that means for the future of work. Nick, thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Alex, what's up? Excited to be here.
Thank you. Everything AI is up, as usual, in the AI Marketing Navigator world. But first, I want to kind of start picking your brain around your amazing education in the philosophy of human-computer interaction, which just sounds like a nerd's dream, to be honest. I'm very curious. Can you give us the 5-minute, the 101 on the philosophy of human-computer interaction? What does that practice in theory involve?
Yeah, if you've ever seen those newsreels of World War II test pilots getting strapped into chairs and put on rocket sleds just to see their faces melt against the bone structure of their skull, that was the predecessor to human-computer interaction. That was called human factors, where they were trying to see the comfort level of a chair or of a control, or see how far they could push the human body before it breaking. And human factors was in an industrial design, a predecessor to industrial design, to make sure that things felt right. But in the digital world, we didn't have rocket sleds back in the 1950s. We had old computers that were just now coming into being. But with the advent in the 1980s and 90s of computers and being accessible towards the masses or integrated into our workflows, we need to better understand how human beings like us, presumably you're not a bot or an algorithm that's programmed to ask me hard-hitting questions, we needed to better understand how we interacted with them. And so HCI was how I describe what my father might have done if he had gone into my profession for his career, whereas he was trying to understand the behaviors between humans and computers. And my education has always been in schools of architecture because there was money there. And these were the days before the internet and e-commerce made money here, where architects were using computer-aided design tools, CAD software, to build buildings. And so it was really one of the nexus of human-computer interaction was through schools of architecture. And then that got appropriated into allied arts, which graphic design, then evolving to become interaction design and what we knew as web design. And so human-computer interaction was, that's your backstory, from rocket sleds to user experience.
Amazing. And I love the analogy so much. I can fully picture myself sitting in front of an early computer experience and feeling like I was in a rocket sled, I think. So you're still involved in the world of academia. You do client and industry work as well. How do you, is it a challenge to balance the world of teaching, the world of getting into the practice and the theory, and then trying to bring that into an office, into an executive boardroom, and explain why things are supposed to look like they're supposed to look like?
That's a great question. And it is a balance. I think the way that you described it was good. But the way to achieve balance is to constantly move forward, as well as to always adjust your stance at any point. And if I didn't have that exposure to theory, of there are different organizations with whom I consult that have different theories about what workflow or tools or capabilities they want to employ, I wouldn't be able to practice this not only in front of the class or students, but also going forward. I am so wonderfully blessed and cursed with the ability to reinvent myself every 6 months, because different clients have different requests, and you've got to really understand and make it up as you go along.
Absolutely. I find that fascinating, that being involved in both worlds and what that must mean from teaching someone what the foundations versus seeing it in practice in real life. I think that gives you a unique perspective.
This summer was let's tear it all down. Let's rewrite the curriculum, because what has happened from the summer of 2024 to the summer of 2025, as it relates to the use of design tools, the integration of AI and go-to-market offerings, and how we incorporate this data literacy, those kinds of components and facets have changed so rapidly in the last 12 months that it requires a reassessment and different communication strategies to people who are coming into the field and want to know how it's going to change their career.
Of course. I find myself thinking about students in this day who are going to be completely AI native and born in the world of AI, and what that's going to change as far as education, work, all of that. Let's step back a little bit and talk. You said how much things were changing in the field. Let's talk about AI design versus the traditional methods a little bit. Based on your experience with both, and now having some experience in the AI-assisted workflows, where do you see the biggest advantages of AI coming into the field, into the industry? What are some of the limitations? Can you give us some insight into that?
Yeah, the design field, design operations, over the last 10 years have been wonderful at systematizing our process of design in enterprise environments. Think design patterns, component libraries, brand kits, those types of, let's make sure that everything we do is modular. And one thing that these algorithms are good at is understanding, interpreting, and delivering back patterns that it sees, whether it be language models or whether it be visual patterns. And so that has been something that is fundamental, is that these pattern libraries are now sort of instruction materials for a algorithm that you can teach it this model to say that work within this library, use these variables and these components, and then begin to start from there. I think one of the misnomers of the fancy demos you see on LinkedIn is that it is really amazing and wonderful to go from zero to one. Even the product V0 is very well named, because you are going from scratch into something that you can say, wow, that's amazing. But a lot of designers don't work without such constraint. They have a pattern library that their department or organization has to follow. They have a code base in which their front-end team has to incorporate. And you can't just say, aha, I made something in Lovable, or I made something in Magic Patterns that we can now use. I think it's great for a brainstorming tool or a wireframing tool where you want to see what some of the possibilities are. A lot of these text-to-design algorithms are brochure-based. I had a conversation with a CEO who is building one of those, and I said, I don't do a lot of brochureware. A lot of my UI, UX applications are for internal tools. And so those kind of components tend to be more intricate and less off the shelf as, say, the ShadCN libraries. And so I know I'm winding my way around the question around the impact of AI and design. But I think it's understanding the disciplines of what we can do given the context and the tools we have, And that mandates understanding the outputs and the tools that are now being placed before our fingertips.
Sure, of course. No, I think that's a great answer. And it leads me into kind of another question. You were mentioning about how you do a lot of internal work and how the systems that you are working in and that employees are often working in aren't as flexible as a Lovable or as a Figma, where it's like, hey, just look at this pretty web page I built. No, you're doing massive, massive data visualization. So can you talk a little bit about, have you had any experience yet bringing AI into an internal system, training it on internal design patterns and models or component libraries? What does that look like now? Is there progress in AI for the enterprise ecosystem being made?
If you choose it to be, I had the fortune of coming back into a client that I'd worked for in 2023, 2024. And back then, way back then, we delivered a beautiful Figma deck. We had all the screens and workflows itemized and laid out, and it was using this organization's pattern library, and it was chef's kiss of a UI UX deliverable. We solved all the problems, clapped our hands, and then went away, as most consultants do. And then I got a call back in fall of last year to come and start 2025 with them in the revamp of that same workflow, that same product, because they had done a development effort and they wanted to come back in and go further with it. And so, again, the fortune and the blessing of coming back and seeing what had developed. And it was dropped on the floor, run over by a tractor, and then picked apart by vultures.
Oh my goodness.
The development team either didn't have the capability, the priority, or the resources to implement anything we designed. And it was left to the hands of a new front-end developer who wasn't very experienced at interpreting design components or incorporating any of these kinds of libraries. And I vowed on this second run through not to make the same mistake. I was brought in the first time by the VP of design. I was brought in the second time by the VP of product. And that VP of product didn't have as much allegiance to the design workflow as maybe the VP of design would have. So rather than having to, again, as consultants, you have a 6-month runway. Like, you've got to get it done one way or the other. And so I wasn't going to put components into a queue to be reviewed by a design board to get sent back to get then approved to then get put into the queue by the front end design team to eventually get implemented, because they were putting out their own fires and that team of five to make sure that everybody was using the brand guidelines and the pattern libraries that this organization was maintaining was a bridge too far given our desired velocity. So instead of starting at the beginning with Figma, we started at the finish. We had access to the GitHub repo in which the front end code base was located in. We brought that down and cloned it and used Cursor and IDE and learned to establish guardrails and build rules so that when we asked Cursor to generate a navigation structure or an error state or a toast notification, that it did so using the components that were already in place and wouldn't bring in outside libraries like shadcn. It wouldn't make any changes to the package.json files because of dependencies. It would stop and ask, do you want to create a new component? If so, how do we mark it? How do we organize it? Do we want to use the existing variables and introduce new ones? And so we would tailor our design progress towards the front-end developer for which this would be handed off to. And being good UX practitioners, this was also something we were using for prototypes. This was all stood up by a Google Sheets quote database using tabs within Google Sheets to understand how the data would flow. The application itself was responsible for doing hundreds of millions of dollars in financial deals between this organization and its partners. And The problem was that people would go through this 11-step process in the preparation of these deals and make a mistake and have to do remits or have to do corrections. And the impact of making errors without realizing it was in the tens of millions of dollars, without exaggeration. Mm-hmm. And so the importance of data hygiene and legibility was paramount. So we felt like it was important enough to understand how that data was being transformed and transferred from step to step to step. And eventually, when the front end team implemented it, it was in Snowflake or Postgres database. But when we were doing it, we were ensuring that, hey, here's a Google Sheet and there's an API that's calling Google Sheets. And at each step, the data gets transformed in this manner. And here are these pivot tables and on and on and on.
Wow.
And so that I will never work any other way again. And going back to your earlier question about design and what people coming into the field might be experiencing. My mid designer that I worked with, junior designer, was out of school, my alma mater CCA here in San Francisco. And she had spent 4 years learning how to use Figma. And this was her first job out of school. And I'm sure she was, you know, saddled up and ready to go and show the world what she knew with this piece of software. And within 3 weeks of this contract, I said, we're going to put this down and we're not going to make the same mistake we did the last time I had this contract. You and I are going to figure out this workflow and in this environment of a new way of working where we're much closer to the development team. We're reducing that long tradition of a gap between design and development. And we're playing by the rules for which we want this product to be built.
Wow. So much value to be unpacked there. If you guys, navigators out there listening, are experiencing something similar, going into an enterprise, listen to the parts of this conversation where you were able to take cursors, something incredibly flexible and powerful, something absolutely AI born and native, and give it guardrails. Can you give us a little bit more insight into what exactly that the tactics were for giving those guardrails to cursor? Was that just native cursor? Was it the web version? Did you bring it down locally into the existing IDE? What did that look like from a technical perspective?
Yeah. As I said, the organization had a code component library. They had a storybook. They had these patterns with which had already been built. And our model for which we were going to train our interactions with cursor were those components. And so we brought those in and itemized them and made sure that Cursor knew the organization and the structure of those building blocks. And we also refined our use of Cursor to say it's going to be React version 1.14, it's going to be Tailwind version such and such and such, and install all the packages that you see within this repository and lock the package.json file and don't install anything else because you can't go back to the development team and say, hey, I did this thing, but look at all these dependencies that I brought with me. And so those kinds of constraints and build rules, I think it's the hangover of this generative environment of,
yep.
Oh, you did these wonderful things, but it's not ready for the real world. And we did this with the help of a front-end engineer where from our consultancy, 20% of our contract was given to a front-end engineer that was freelancing and gave us 10 hours a week to say, here's the mistakes you're making. And so it behooves us as designers, as marketers, to make sure that we stand shoulder to shoulder with somebody who maybe understands the environment and the technology a little bit more. Help us with the merge conflicts and version control issues that come with a development environment like that. And they're not insurmountable. They may be some new languages that we need to learn how to speak a little better. But, again, Cursor's great at understanding how to resolve those types of errors and those conflicts. You just plug it right back into the system and it knows where we're stepping on each other's toes. And so with those building blocks in place, you can begin to create interfaces and you'll make sure that you're referencing what parts of the page and what IDs or component names you're using. There's a number of different tricks and standards that as you get more adept with using and assembling applications using this, it becomes a little clearer about the ways to function within it.
Fascinating. Like I said, guys, so much value to be had there. If this is what it takes when you're taking it past just that prototype phase, just the pretty web page built with Lovable. If you really need something meaningful to an enterprise that is when there's tens of millions of dollars on the line, there's still much need for human in the loop, much need for engineer in the loop.
Thanks for listening to the AI Marketing Navigator. Ready to simplify your own marketing automation? Digital Pop helps make it happen so your small business can scale your marketing fast. Learn more at thedigitalpop.com.